Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it's now or never. That debt is fraud. We need to continue to learn, and hopefully, folks, going through the Constitution, every year we do this because we go through the ratification debates and we're trying to connect the dots for you. But we're hoping that this really helps you understand what those clauses are really saying and what was really granted there, because most people just think that the Supreme Court is, you know, the final arbiters for God and everybody on this earth. And that's not the case. And so we're covering Article 3, but going through this and helping you understand precisely what's in that Constitution, then we now can see, and because we're learning, that goes right in line with our Learn, Pray, Act, because it helps us understand really where the problems is, how to address these things, and what to ask for to get the redress of our grievances and fix these problems. So, in a nutshell, it is all about full compliance to this very document. And I'm here to tell you, if you don't read the Ten Commandments, then you have no idea what is considered a sin versus, you know, in the Old Testament era, and how we should be living, at least on the historical side, of how the Ten Commandments. It's interesting, the Bill of Rights and so forth. But anyway, the Ten Commandments and how they were basically refined by our Savior in the New Testament. And so, where he so eloquently basically put it into two commandments. Anyway, and if you really look, welcome back, Sean. So, I mean, I know this is, you know, kind of within your grasp here. I mean, it's very profound how the Lord kind of took those two, he took the Ten Commandments and he put them into two commandments, and you can see that. But actually, let me just say this, that even knowing those two commandments doesn't really help, and I'll give you a good case in point. The commandment on adultery states that thou shalt not have, you know, not to perform adultery, not, you know, engage in a sexual act between, you know, two married people outside of marriage, and or, you know, a married person and a non-married person. Don't commit adultery, period. You keep it within the marriage. And later on in Christ's ministry, he basically says when a man has looked at a woman with lust in his heart, he's committed adultery already. Well, under the old definition, when you read and understand the words, and then in looking at the way Christ basically consolidated the Ten Commandments in loving the Lord with all thy heart, all thy might, right? And so it kind of takes those first, whatever, six commandments or what have you, and kind of, you know, boils them into that one. But my point is this, is that when somebody is only taught those few words, and they're not reading the scriptures, then they have no clue really how to live, you know, in accordance to the law. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir, it does.
Awesome. So that's why reading the scriptures, that's why reading the Constitution and the ratification debates, because the ratification debates explain the Constitution. Now, when we look at the scriptures, the Ten Commandments, one would say, oh, you know, the Constitution is so convoluted, so difficult. I'm saying, no, it's not. Not really. I think it's simpler than God's law and living God's law, because there's all sorts of dilemmas and so forth. That's why we have such a large magnitude of scriptures, right? So,
yes, sir.
So, because there's always, you know, a unique situation that pops up. So, anyway, and I want to kind of get focused on getting back to the Constitution, because I'm looking, and here, you know, we're already on, what is it, the 15th of October, and so we've started. It's almost been a month, and we're still in Article 3. So I want to get a little bit more committed to, you know, being focused on the content. Not that we haven't been, but there's been some meandering and wandering and so forth, and that's my fault. So anyway, folks, we covered the jurisdiction. I want to do a go back. And in the go back, we identified the jurisdiction for the court in Article 1, Section 2 is all things that arise under this Constitution. And so go ahead and read that first stanza again, and then we're going to, you know, just we're going to just read them. Because, folks, what we're going to do is Sean's going to read the first stanza, then he's going to add the stanza that follows that, that kind of expands it into an international court, so they have jurisdiction over the international stuff, and so forth. So, and then what I want to do, because I mentioned the Articles of Confederation, I'm going to read how the jurisdiction was delegated to Continental Congress. Because, see, they didn't have a judiciary. Continental Congress was the executive, they were the legislative, and they were the judiciary. And so when we look, and there's a reason why, because the 11th Amendment actually wipes clean, you know, all of the following, or the last three or four clauses of jurisdiction. But there's a unique clause in there, and I'm going to show you it's almost word for word from the Articles of Confederation, why they put that in. Because they wanted to make sure that that was a very, because it's a very specific situation. Let me have you read the first one, and then we'll take it from there.
Article 3, Section 2, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority.
Okay.
To all cases affecting ambassadors and other public ministers and councils.
Okay, so right there, that's an add-on. So their hard jurisdiction, folks, is all things arising under the Constitution. If it's in the Constitution, then, and that's not a word like that. Oh, well, there's that in the Constitution, and there's that in this particular case. And when I say that, I'm just talking about the word THAT. No, it has to be the very specific enumerated objects. Madison actually stated this in the ratification debates. Their jurisdiction extends to the enumerated objects. So when we, and there's the roles and responsibilities, those other things that arise under the Constitution, that if there were problems, they would have to adjudicate. But to be clear, they do not wander beyond those things enumerated in the Constitution. And granted, the amendments, because they didn't include the amendments there, but there were amendments that were added to this. So then you went into all cases affecting ambassadors and other public ministers and councils. That's a very specific clause that deals with American citizens that are dealing with foreign nations in foreign nations, or foreigners in America dealing with the United Nations, or I should say the United States. Sorry about that. And so that's a very specific case or international law situation that they have jurisdiction. So the carte blanche, everything that arises under the Constitution, and then in addition to that, they have to have jurisdiction over these international dealings with foreign nations. Now, there's another one. Go ahead.
To all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction.
Okay, so that happens to deal with the trade, with trade agreements and those types of things, so that they have jurisdiction pulling that away from the states. Because when we go through the Articles of Confederation, you're going to notice that certain things aren't listed here. Okay, so what's the next one?
To controversies to which the United States shall be a party.
There you go. And in addition, the last jurisdiction right here.
To controversies between two or more states.
Okay, so controversies between two or more states. In other words, the federal government was supposed to be the peacekeeper. They weren't to be the regulator of states. They were only to make sure that states weren't taking advantage of each other. So that's why the Commerce Clause said that the federal government had the power to regulate commerce among the states, not within the states. And as the Supreme Court, because the Federalist Papers has aggrandized themselves to basically become, and they've elevated themselves to a position of God, then in our republic, that they have actually created, by their own doing, a judiciary form of government, wiping out our republican form of government. All unconstitutional, folks. But let me give you the Articles of Confederation. Now, you can download the Articles of Confederation. They're posted on the academic source documents, folks. So go ahead and, if you want to, pull it down. And all I'm doing is a search in the document for jurisdiction. And the first jurisdiction, the first case comes up in Article 2. And it says, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. In other words, that's almost like the 10th Amendment, right?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Just to be clear, that's basically saying that, hey, you guys are sovereign over all those things that involves your jurisdiction and everything else. Okay, so what's the next word of jurisdiction? It pops into Article 4, and it's highlighted for you, and it says, if any person guilty of or charged with treason, felony, or other high misdemeanor in any state shall flee from justice and be bound in any of the United States, he shall, upon the demand of the governor or executive power of the state. So they're already identifying that not all states have governors, but they do have, every state has executive power. How they've configured the states, again, I keep saying this, that the states were different. They all weren't the same. And the federal government had no business saying that you guys had to, you know, all get along the way we want you to and be formed the way we want you to, and you're going to do what we tell you to. The Constitution would have been rejected on that premise right there. That power was never delegated, but anyway, so the executive power of the state from which he fled, or that person, the criminal has fled, be delivered up and removed to the state having jurisdiction of this offense. Now, we're going to find this same clause worded differently in Article 4, so we're just about to get there, but this is another jurisdiction that the Continental Congress has, and it's basically saying that, hey, you have to surrender a person if they flee to your state for, you know, hiding or to, you know, get away from the law of another state. So the next case, the third instance, is in Article 4 as well, and it says, the United States in Congress assembled shall also be the last resort on appeal in all disputes and differences now subsisting or that hereafter may arise between two or more states concerning boundary jurisdiction or any other cause whatever, which authority shall always be exercised in the manner following. And then they basically lay it all out. So what is this jurisdiction akin to in what you read?
I'm not sure.
It's the controversies between two or more states. It's okay. It's that last one. They're basically in this four lines of words. They basically said that the judicial power shall extend to controversies between two or more states. That's what they basically said here, and because that's exactly how it was put in the second part, in the second line, that hereafter may arise between two or more states concerning what the types of issues. Well, they didn't have to list all the types of issues. They basically said, hey, if there's a matter that's a controversy between two or more states, then we have jurisdiction to solve the case for you, to resolve that. Not to force you into doing, you know, anything, but to resolve who might be at fault or identify, hey, you don't have the authority to do that or what have you, like when it comes to the Commerce Clause. So, okay, so the next jurisdiction pops in, and this is in Article 9. All controversies concerning the private right of soil claimed under different grants of two or more states whose jurisdiction, as they may respect such lands, and the states which pass such grants are adjusted the said grants or either of them being at the same time claimed to have originated incident to such settlement of jurisdiction shall on the petition of either party to the Congress of the United States shall be the final determined as near as may be the same manner as before prescribed for deciding disputes respecting territorial jurisdictions between the different states. So this is like a six-line detail that actually identifies one of the jurisdictions that has been changed by the 11th Amendment, and it is this one. The power shall extend to, between cases of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states. In other words, this actually, in some cases, may be a situation where it's affecting two states. Or it could be a matter where it is an individual that is having a claim of land in that other state. It kind of falls under a dual umbrella. If it is between one state and another citizen, then the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction. But if it is a claim between two states, and how can that be? So when the states actually created a new territory, and then they developed that territory, and let's go with Virginia had Kentucky. When Kentucky became a state, there may have been some issues where these claims on these lands had to be done a certain way, and when Kentucky came along, they became a sovereign state. And so the people who own that land may say, hey, you know, you guys have completely changed the agreement that we had with the other state. And therefore, that right there becomes an issue that actually goes to the Supreme Court, because it's literally a claim between two different states. You just got a party in between them. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I wanted to clarify that one line can actually be two different situations and or probably a multitude of, but if it boils down to a case between two states, the Supreme Court will have jurisdiction. If it's a case where it's really about a private citizen making a claim about land in another state, then that is to be resolved by the state where the land resides. So that means that the Supreme Court does not have jurisdiction, which means that the 11th Amendment applies to that part. So what we've done is I've kind of highlighted the words that are italicized, but I've highlighted the words in red. This way, it kind of identifies that this could actually fall into jurisdiction under the Supreme Court in a certain case and jurisdiction to the states only in a certain case, that very specific language. Because it's too short and too brief to, you know, cover all the types of instances. And so, but the 11th Amendment, and let me go through this, as I did before, the 11th Amendment really says this because it's very simple. The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state. So if it falls under that case, then it cannot be extended to them. So in other words, you have to have a pretty decent filter to differentiate between the types of cases regarding land grants and two different states. So did I help clarify? Because that's the whole point of going back to do this was to do that. Did that help clarify that one clause?
I'm not going to say yes.
Okay. All right. Because I'm not paying you to say yes.
No. Okay. I mean, I'm trying to wrap my head around it. Uh-huh. I believe I understand what you're talking about. This last part in the 11th Amendment, not construed to extend to any suit in law, equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state.
Right. So in other words,
individual citizens, the Supreme Court doesn't have jurisdiction over citizens like from Louisiana having a case against somebody in Virginia.
Or let's say Arkansas.
State of Virginia.
So let's say you have a citizen in Louisiana and they bought land in Arkansas. And so they're having a dispute over the land in Arkansas. It's not covered under the land grants where the state actually created, the state of Louisiana, because in this particular case, Arkansas was not a treaty or a territory, I should say, of Louisiana. There were cases currently. So let's back up. When you look at the United States under the Articles of Confederation, the states were perpetual. If you actually looked at the way the states claimed, Virginia went from the Atlantic coast horizontally across the United States to the Pacific coast. In other words, it was going to be one solid stripe. As it developed its territory, it would then be brought into the state and they would gain representation at the state level. They were to develop their own territory. They were their own sovereign nation. Now, under the new U.S. Constitution and admitting new states into the Union, the states and their current boundaries are set. They may have territories that they've got claims and they've already started nurturing. And at the time of the Constitution, there were actually a few states that were that way. So we already know that Vermont was a state that came out of New Hampshire. And actually, I think it may have came out of New York. Forgive me. But I think it was Maine that came out of New Hampshire. Maine was a territory that was kind of being built and expanded as a claim by New Hampshire. Because I don't think, what is underneath that is Massachusetts, right? I think. But anyway, if you look, there were these territories that the states were developing prior to the Constitution. So it was going to expand. New Hampshire was going to expand itself into the land of Maine, and that would have been New Hampshire. Just like Virginia was going to expand itself into the land of what we call Kentucky, and that would have just all been one big Virginia. Technically, Virginia has been cut twice. Virginia was cut from Kentucky coming out of Virginia, and then West Virginia, because of the Civil War, West Virginia broke away from Virginia as well. But that was under the splitting of a state under Article 4, Section 3. We'll get into that. But the point is that there was a problem in the paradigm because the Constitution needed to create fixed nations, that not perpetual nations that would extend, that the state of Virginia was going to be this fixed state and nation based on that boundary. So the territory that they were calling Kentucky was going to become a state under this new constitution, just like Tennessee, just like Vermont, just like Maine. And if you kind of look to the west of Pennsylvania was Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And I think maybe Minnesota was a part of that as well. I think it went to the Mississippi, whatever that was. That was the Northwest Territory that was kind of brought in under the Continental Congress in a different way, and it was superseded by the Constitution. That's the most important thing. The Northwest Ordinance was superseded. It basically became a dead letter, and it should never have seen the light of day in the admission of states, period. So if I wandered far enough and gone into enough detail to help move on to finishing up Section 3 of Article 3. Are we there? Okay. All right.
So basically the Constitution superseded the Articles of Confederation and the way that the states developed their territory.
Yes, actually. So no, it didn't, but yes, it did. So every state that ratified this new compact abandoned the Articles of Confederation and went into this new union. And the states that stayed behind, which technically when the new government formed, there were only two states that stayed behind. That was North Carolina and Rhode Island. All the other states adopted, and we're going into a break here in just a sec, all the other states adopted this new paradigm and this new form of government. the other two states remained in the Articles of Confederation and Continental Congress. Now, I'm here to tell you that there's no way that those states maintained Continental Congress, because I think at that point in time, Continental Congress was in Pennsylvania. That being said, when we come back, we'll wrap up Article 3, and any other questions, if I haven't answered them for Sean, we'll try to answer those first before we move on. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so everything, the Articles of Confederation and everything that they were creating regarding laws and the domestic matters of the Articles of Confederation, or I should say the Union of those 13 states and their territories, were all superseded. Now, we're actually going to get into, I think it's in Article 4, where we actually find the good faith and credit and everything that was done before will still be in effect. So we'll cover that. Because if there was a treaty that was created by the Articles of Confederation, in other words, Continental Congress's treaty, let's keep in mind, folks, that Virginia had treaties. And North Carolina had treaties, and Massachusetts. These big states had their own treaties on trade and so forth. Those were wiped out. Those did not transpire over. Only things that the Articles of Confederation or Continental Congress in their debt agreements, because some of these other states had their own debts as well. So the only thing that was shifted from the old government to this new constitutional federal government that was being created were those things that Continental Congress did that was external. In other words, they wanted to make sure that nobody was going to be alarmed that this new government was going to abandon and not take and consider paying their legitimate debts. That doesn't mean if there were debts out there that weren't under the Articles of Confederation or they took on debt that they shouldn't have taken, then I don't think that those would have been legitimate. But we can talk about that in just a minute. But let's wrap up Article 3, Section 3. So we covered the treason and this, how they defined it. Now, out the gate, I think we mentioned the Whiskey Rebellion, correct?
Yes, sir.
So out the gate, the Whiskey Rebellion did actually extend to, because it didn't have to be an overt act of war, right? Because that's what they're saying. Somebody that consists of levying war against them. What this was an insurrection. And they looked at insurrections as a necessity of mobilizing the national army or creating and federalizing the state militias into a national army. So when they had to do that to quell this insurrection, then they considered that an act of war. Because they technically, they already, by this point in time, the Bill of Rights had been ratified, correct? Okay, because we're talking about 1792. 1792, the Bill of Rights were ratified, and in 1794 is when the militia finally went out to basically put down this insurrection, because the insurrection was moving eastward, going into Pittsburgh and into Pennsylvania, because they were on the march. They were, by this point in time, nobody had done anything to them, that they were enabled, and there were a lot of people that were joining the insurrection. And so they realized that they needed to do something, and they recognized that this was basically standing up and taking on war against a legitimate government, because they were literally denying and moving in a manner that was considered a direct hostility or threat. Even though they didn't wage war, they didn't declare war, nor did Congress, because Congress didn't need to declare war. This was an insurrection based on the Constitution. So my point, folks, is that insurrections can easily be extended into treason without actually the declarations of war. Because when your own citizens basically stand up against legitimate law and say, we will defy you, we're not a part of this anymore. And so this should actually probably get Sean's, you know, gears in his head thinking, this about what about the sovereign citizens? What about the Antifa? I mean, it's not just Antifa. There's lots of groups out there that have actually taken contrary positions violently against the Constitution. As a matter of fact, the Communist Party. The Democratic Party. And actually...
the Republican Party.
Well, so the Republican Party, they're just swimming in this mess of government, and they're accepting all of the illegitimate government. But that's another thing. I would actually say those who are literally trying to destroy and set aside the Constitution, which would be Antifa, which would be the Democratic Party, which would be Bill Gates, which would be the Islam presence in America. The Islamic presence in America is literally trying to destroy the Constitution. So there are absolutely right now insurrections that need to be quelled, and these people need to be, technically, it's treason, but I would basically say they just need to be deported, because if they're no longer going to be supporting the Constitution, I think we need to probably go to the higher ground, and instead of hanging all of them, I think we have the right to seize all their assets. We have the right to take everything from Bill Gates and all of these billionaires who are working to overthrow and basically take and subjugate us to their new global government. So, as we, you know, get rid of these people, we take their assets, and I say we ship them to the communist country that they want to go to, China, Russia, North Korea, whichever one. But, you know, we're not going to, you know, inflict some good liberty-minded nation with these bad people, these bad actors. So we can deport them, because we already did that with the Tory Acts. We took the British loyalists who weren't going to support this new government of liberty, said, okay, you're done, you're out of here. And they kicked them out, and most of them went up to Canada. But many of them, a bunch of them that had the money, or I should say, were willing to get on ships and pay for their own voyage back, but they left everything else behind. All their property was taken from them. Whatever they could carry, they were allowed to carry. And that was it. And so they didn't have lots of gold back in those days. So whatever they could carry, if it was scrip, it was probably worthless. But my point is that when we look at today, this treason, or this really does fall under these insurrections that we're seeing and going on. And so technically, these people could be convicted of treason. I would say that they basically should lose their citizenship. And if they're that much of a threat, like Bill Gates, he has the resources to actually continue to wage his warfare, and he's not going to stop, then we need to seize everything. And almost every single executive in Microsoft, and every single executive in all of these other big corporations and companies, Facebook, what have you, that are working to undermine and overthrow our Constitution, they're gone. They got to get out of here. We got to get rid of them. We're not obligated to keep our enemies here and allow them to just basically take advantage and succeed. We're not obligated to let them succeed. And as a matter of fact,
and we had the mechanisms in place to peacefully deal with this if people were aware and educated of them.
There you go. There you go. Okay. So the following clause to Section 3, which closes out Article 3, what is that? Go ahead.
The Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted.
Okay. So this is a phrase that they created for a how the corruption, you know, maybe family, because in Britain, they would come in and grab the whole family. And in other kingdoms in history, they wanted to make sure that only those people who were absolutely corrupted, that were, you know, committing treason, would be hanged. And that's what, you know, except during the life of the person attainted, only that person would be basically killed. The whole point of an attainder is basically a capital punishment. So the crimes, bills of attainder and punishment are two types of things. Attainder is a capital punishment, and the others is a punishment of going to jail, a punishment of stealing your property, or somehow taking something from you. Where the whole point of creating a law that would either kill you or punish you is kind of the same thing. So they didn't necessarily include the punishment. It wasn't just about the capital offense. When it comes to bills of attainder, bills of attainder was something that is a law that actually bypasses due process. And it basically takes you where they create a law and they just punish you. There is no due process. That's the whole point of bills of attainder and punishment, which is just like if they said, hey, if you're not vaxxed, then you can't get go into public. Somebody could actually challenge that, and they would have a right to due process. Anyway, and if they got, because what would be the consequence if you go into public? They're going to arrest you. So that type of law means that it became a bill of attainder and punishment. They'd just arrest you and throw you in jail because you were guilty of being non-vaxxed and out in public. They can't. That's the essence of that type of law. Anyway, did that make sense?
Yes, sir. Okay. Would that apply to the masking as well?
Well, so if they arrest you because they've mandated a law that says you must wear a mask in public, anything where they've mandated a very specific behavior where you have to keep 6 feet away from each other, that kind of law is a bill of attainder and punishment that if you violate that, they'll just arrest you and throw you in jail. No, you have a right of due process. Once they arrest you, they have to basically give you a writ of habeas corpus, basically give you the charge, and then you go on bail or you're released on your own recognizance, and you have due process. But the way the laws are, they just arrest you and throw you in jail. That specifically is a bill of attainder and punishment. So anyway, anyhow.
Oh, would the Patriot Act statutes or...
Yes.
Specifics, yeah. What do they call that, rendition?
Well, so the Patriot Act is where under suspicion, they can detain you indefinitely and suspend your right of habeas corpus. They can't do that. They can't do that. The Patriot Act is unconstitutional in so many different ways. So many different ways. And they've been building on it with, these... what are the FISA courts? All these different FISA things courts that they're creating, right? They all of these things that they've been doing in building and taking away our rights, they're all unconstitutional. They can make no law that abridges our right of the person being secure in ourselves, our right of, of habeas corpus, a right of speedy trial, a right of due process. In controversies and something that is greater than $20 in common law, you have a right to a trial by jury. Anyway, okay, so let's get into Article 4. Now, the rest of these are pretty short and sweet, so we've gotten through the bulk of the Constitution, then we just get into the Bill of Rights and Amendments. So Article 1 is what we kind of talked about before, where there's really been no identifiable problem that I've known that was a problem when the United States government assumed the debts and the agreements of Continental Congress with foreign nations. Then there you go. The Northwest Territory was not a foreign nation. It was an organic, domestic compact that was created with the U.S. citizens in the Northwest Territory. That was not international. That area was conceded to us by Britain after the Revolutionary War. So it was not applicable. It was superseded. Everything that was within the domestic matters of the Articles, or I should say Continental Congress, that was all superseded. So let's go ahead and read Section 1.
Article 4, Section 1. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. And the Congress may by general laws prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved and the effect thereof.
Okay, so when I told you the treaties with other states and so forth that were created, some of those, because Congress was basically going to determine what they would bring over, what they wouldn't bring over. And so some of those were deemed, when this was all done, that some of those states actually still had debts with the Bank of England and or with other nations and so forth, because Congress did not assume any debt of those states. They did assume unconstitutionally, because of the Assumption Act, they did assume the debt of those states in paying the war debt. So we're going to get into that when we're all done with this, because that's when we get into the very first acts. Because Congress did not take on that debt. They basically said that we're going to make sure that these other states pay their due. And so what they were going to do was they were going to actually, put out the requisitions and so forth, because at this point in time, they now had the ability to compel the states to pay those debts. And so they had to come up with a way to do that. And Hamilton felt, hey, let's put it all into one big kitty. Let's assume all of the debt of the states, their war debts, and we will just pay the war debt ourselves. And so when we get into the Assumption Act, you're going to actually, because we won't read it in painstaking detail. I may have you or Tammy or both of you suffer through that, but just to the fact that you'll see how excruciating of what Hamilton was actually delivering in this bank system, where all these bonds and the playing of money, what he ended up doing was he basically straddled the entire union with some form of debt and obligation, one way or the other. Some states were given benefit. They were given money. But they were still straddled, or they were still basically brought into this banking system where the people of that state could actually buy bonds. It was a mechanism of selling a product, i.e. bonds, for interest rates that they were going to sell in all the states, and the states had to basically manage all of this. But these bonds would then pay them an interest, but it would be a way of the people investing into the United States and becoming bondholders, which is something that's not in the Constitution. So we're going to go into all of that, and we'll prove how this was just so unconstitutional. And anyway, I just always wondered why Madison and Jefferson didn't run to the states at that point instead of waiting for the Alien Sedition Acts. But anyway, Section 2, there you go, the first part.
Section 2, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states.
Okay, so basically this was extending the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen from going from one state to the next state of their privileges and rights. Now, this didn't mean that it only was capped with those privileges and immunities under the Constitution. I'll give you a good case in point. In the state of New York, if a 14-year-old could drive a wagon, you know, on a road, on a public roadway or in town or what have you, where they had licensing and everything else, and all the states had their own licensing, if in the state of New York they extended a license to that individual, then when that individual traveled through the states that said you had to be 18 or 21 to operate a wagon, well, that didn't preclude him of his right from that state being able to be in these other states and exercise that privilege, that right, that immunity. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so it's called...
What about bearing arms?
Yes, correct. It's this is the reciprocity. So if you have a concealed carry, you have the right of concealed carry in every state. The Constitution protects that. So this is why this particular clause is highlighted in red with yellow text. It is being dramatically violated by many states that have, you know, this warfare against a person's rights and privileges. They don't want you to have the right to carry arms, and they're making it so you can't. And this is actually boiled into the Supreme Court before, where the Supreme Court has actually stood up and said, no, you can't do that. That they've overturned cases, but I don't think they've ever actually got Congress to go and say, Congress, you need to reel in these states that still have these laws on the books. Because that's how it should happen. What the Supreme Court does today, because, again, they've aggrandized themselves into gods, they basically tell everybody, you can't do that, and they give you an edict and so forth. So, anyway, let's go into the next one.
A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed from to the state having jurisdiction of the crime.
Does that sound familiar out of the Articles of Confederation?
Sounds like they copied and pasted.
Almost, because they had the word governor and so forth. But so
right.
The framers basically said when they were being charged that they didn't keep the Articles of Confederation. When we actually get into the Articles of Confederation, you'll actually see how the Articles of Confederation were literally hammered into the Constitution, but they did it in such a better way. You know, instead of adding the governor and all of that, they just said the executive. So instead of taking six lines in the Articles of Confederation, they did it in three. More concise, more clear. They just did. This is what happens when you have the Lord working with you. As a matter of fact, I like to point out how many articles were in the Articles of Confederation. You got them there, so go ahead and count them.
13.
There you go. And so they took that work of men that created 13 articles, and they put everything together where it belonged properly, where it seemed fit. Everything under legislative was in Article 1. Everything under executive was in Article 2. Everything that was under the judiciary, Article 3. Article 4 kind of covered, you know, these other things, not powers, but these other things that they were basically stating, these protections, privileges, immunities, and so forth, kind of Article 4. Article 5 was the process of amending. Article 6 was the supremacy clause. And the, you know, the no religious test. So, you know, these last few, 4, 5, 6, and 7, are very, very short. But my point is, here the good Lord got and took the Articles of Confederation and put them into six articles, and in the seventh article, established the authority of the Constitution given to the states. In other words, that seventh is basically where he rested the power of the Union. Kind of, you know, 6 days and rested the seventh kind of thing. I mean, as I look at this, I just see these parallels, and maybe I'm just, you know, I see what I want to see kind of thing. But it's you can't, you know, when you get into these types of numberings and so forth, and what was happening in that seventh clause or that seventh article, that's clearly identifying, one, that the Constitution is a compact, and who the parties are, and the fact that they're ratifying it makes them the parties. It's a very simple clause, and everybody says, you know, there could be an amendment that would come down in today's age where somebody would say, we need to strike, just get rid of the seventh article and just remove it, delete it. If that happened, it would be lost in future generations to understand who the parties were to the compact. Or at least it wouldn't be galvanized in the Constitution, because the act of ratification, if you look up ratification by definition, it is a formal legal process of accepting a treaty, contract, or compact. And so who is it that's accepting this compact? It is the states, not the president or not the executive, not the judiciary, not Congress, the states. And as Madison and Jefferson point out, that those entities didn't exist until enough of these states had ratified it to give it force. In other words, they created the federal government. They created this constitution and this serving government to serve them, not to serve themselves. And boy, well, things really went south, or really went the wrong direction. But anyway, okay, so now we basically have the last stanza, or the last little paragraph, and this says that this was modified by the 13th Amendment, right? Which is the slave amendment, right? And so at least the second 13th Amendment, I'll explain that to you when we get down to that, if you're not already aware of it. But let's go ahead and read this last one that's been basically wiped out. Go ahead.
No person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due.
And so the 13th Amendment basically says that there's no such labor like that that exists anymore. The 13th Amendment was crafted in such a way that nobody could be a slave labor unless they've committed a crime, right? Because if you read the 13th Amendment, when we get to that, the second 13th Amendment, it'll actually say that only those people who are indentured servants, in other words, because they've committed a crime or they've agreed to be a servant for a period of time to pay debt or to obtain something, because that's what indentured servitude is all about. And indentured servitude was alive and well back in the days of the Constitution. So that wraps up Article 4, Section 1 and 2. Now we have Section 3. This is the admission of new states into the Union. The Articles of Confederation did not have a mechanism to do this, which is why they had to create this treaty or this compact in admitting the Northwest Territory into the Articles of Confederation, or into that Union, or the Confederacy. So what we're going to get into, because we're almost out of time, so what we're going to get into, folks, is a very specific process of how states were to join the Union. And everything we look at, and this is why I will introduce one of, you know, of the five, we're going to read the Louisiana Enabling Act. So in so doing, I'll help everybody kind of see how Louisiana, other than the treaties, because they couldn't negate the treaties in the admission, other than the treaties themselves, because there were those hard trade treaties with France and Spain, everything else, they were a sovereign state. They came in with full equal footing. And so with that, we'll start off with Article 4, Section 3 tomorrow. I'm Jared Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.